so with kindness when it says the door of my heart is open. No matter what I am experiencing, that is the letting go part of loving kindness and compassion. And these are all different ways of asking you to let go. And I did mention that a long time ago, looking through the teachings of the Buddha, trying to find where this letting go is taught by the Buddha, and there was one place where he goes into actually quite a bit of detail on how to let go. And that is in the very first sermon, in the second factor of the Four Noble Truths. Letting go of craving, the third factor. Letting go of craving leads to nibbana. And there you'll find the four ways of letting go, which the Buddha taught. And that was a little detail which many people just pass over. They can chant that, they can read it, but they don't pause long enough to say, here is the Buddha talking about four little ways of learning how to let go of things. And those four in brief are chaga, pati, nisaga, mutti, and alaya. And the first one of chaga literally does mean this generosity. And this generosity is not just, you know, giving donations. Now people think that's all generosity means, writing out a check, getting out something from your wallet, and putting it in, not the donation box, but, as I say, we did try this once, but people actually changed it back again. Instead of having donation boxes in monasteries, we should not have donation boxes, we should have letting go boxes. Which is encouraging people to understand that what this really is not just raising funds, it's encouraging people just to let go of some attachments as well. And I've often mentioned to people that, I mentioned this recently in a talk I gave, a cancer support group or something. Anyway, it was a talk outside the Buddhist Center that research which is continually to prove this point, that people who do earn too much money have too much suffering. Now, if you have lots of money, you have excess income, more than you actually need, you have to invest it somewhere and you have to find ways of getting maximum returns. You have to watch out for financial advisors who are fraudulent. Watch out for investing in schemes and stock markets where you're going to lose a lot of money. And sometimes your family and friends want some help in their life or in their businesses. And it's a lot of responsibility and trouble when you have, you know, too much money. And it's also, we all know that obviously if you have too little money, it's also a great difficulty for you. And so psychologists and sociologists have worked out there is actually an optimum income for a person. And if they just get around that income, they're the happiest. They have enough money to enjoy their life, you know, to have disposable income, as they say, but not too much that causes a great burden and worry to you. We always think that more money, the better. That's actually not true. One of the stories which somebody sent to me, which, you know, was a wonderful story, was of the woman who won £42 million in the British lottery, which is a lot of money, £42 million. And first thing she did was buy a nice mansion in the countryside in the south of England. And then 1 year later she sold the mansion at a great loss. And some newspaper, you know, asked her what she was doing. And this was an article which somebody sent me, and the sub-editor of the newspaper, he called the article, they always give it a title, and it was, "Honey, I Can't Find the Kids." Because what had happened in her house was it was so big that every child had their own group of rooms and her husband had his own group of rooms. And it's such a huge house and they were all spread out in their own little quarters that they never saw each other. So, you know, the son was in one part of the house, the daughter another part of the house, the husband, I don't know where he was. And so the wife never saw her family, never saw her kids. And so she saw it, the great expansive house was breaking up her family. So she sold it and moved into a very small house. She She said, it's very small, but now I see my husband and my kids so many times every day. And I love that little story, because in modern world, sometimes our houses are so big. And Australia is the worst in the whole world, apparently. We've got the biggest houses in the world. Our houses are so big that we never see each other. And I always like reminding people, especially those who've been brought up in Asia, you know, whether it's in some village in Thailand, or in some little village in Sri Lanka or Indonesia somewhere, that, you know, you share the house with so many people, and some of you share the bed with five or six brothers or five or six sisters, the same bed, for goodness sake. And you learn how to love one another. And, you know, you're still very close together to this very day. And modern people, they have their own room. They don't learn how to get on with each other. They lose out on a very important part of life, learning how to tolerate one another, to cooperate. Imagine five or six young men sleeping in the same bed. That takes a lot of cooperation. And now you get a guy and a girl trying to sleep together after a few weeks of marriage. They just divorce because they can't stand each other. They haven't learned how to live together. And so I always really like the idea of small houses. But anyway, this is one example. It's an optimum income. And if you go over that income, you get more sad. Less, you haven't got enough to get by. I've always mentioned that to people. And the person I mentioned this to, you know, she said she'd heard about that. She was a very wealthy person. She said it was about $150,000 each. I think she was actually exaggerating. But I think it used to be about $50,000, maybe about $70,000, $80,000 now. So it's to make you happier. If there's anyone over here in this retreat who's earning more than $70,000 or $80,000 a year, I can make you happier. Out of great compassion and kindness and sacrifice, I can increase your happiness. And the donation box is over there. But all this really, really means is there is just the right amount. Why is it that people find it hard just to let go of things and to share things? I think you all know, and I know this, that, you know, there was times like yesterday, you know, you had an ice cream here, and I had an ice cream, but I gave it away. Because I thought it was much nicer that somebody else has the ice cream than I have the ice cream. You get much more happy. The ice cream is more delicious if you give it to somebody else, because that makes your heart very good. Have you ever noticed that? And people, psychologists, have seen this. They give people like $10 and tell half the people you can, you know, use it yourself, buy whatever you want. And the other people, they sort of they go and give it away to somewhere. And they do a very quick psychology test to see who gets more happiness. It's always the people who give it away get much more happiness. And that's beautiful to see that, because that idea of chaga, giving, is actually a great source of peace and happiness. But it's not just money. It's giving time and effort. You know, cleaning up the place before you leave. Not just cleaning it to the standard required, cleaning more than the standard required. Now you see something in the toilet which is dirty, you clean it up. Now you see something which is misplaced, you put it in the right place. Now you do that little bit extra there, you care for the place. It's the giving of your time and effort. You get so much happiness back as a result. And in the retreat, it's not just for me. It's not my retreat and everyone else, keep out. You know, you actually care for people and give to people. And when you do that, you get a great boost of happiness. You are letting go. And it's not just giving a little bit of extra energy. It's also the forgiving. So these people here really irritated you. And we all irritate one another. You know, I irritate you with my bad jokes. I wasn't a bad joke. It's just this one came up the other day. That this little boy goes into the hairdresser shop, and the guy comes along and said, which would you rather have, a dollar or three quarters? A dollar coin or 75 cents, the quarters. And the boy says, I'll take the three quarters. And when he walks out, the hairdresser, the barber says, see, this guy's really stupid, this boy is really dumb. Now, every time I tell him this, he always takes the three quarters. He never takes a dollar. He's stupid. And after the guy has finished his getting his hair done, he goes outside and sees the boy. He's bought an ice cream with his 75 cents. And the guy says, "What? Why do you do this? Don't you know that $1 is worth more than 75 cents? And the boy said, "Yes, of course I know that. But as soon as I accept the dollar, the game is over." That's a very smart little boy. Playing dumb, because every time he gets the 75 cents. But anyway, when you give it to other people, you always get very happy. And it's also forgiving. Forgiving me for my stupid jokes. And forgiving each other, you know, for making a noise. What you're actually doing there is giving people the benefit of the doubt. Now, sometimes we always think they do it on purpose. Like the lady said, "My husband's always looking at the other girls." You know, you should be happy. At least you know he's not gay. And please apologize for another bad joke. So when you give people the benefit of the doubt like that, it's amazing you don't have this great burden of worry on you all the time. You're actually letting go of negativity and fault-finding, which is what forgiving really does. It gives this bigger idea of letting go of the fault-finding mind. It's so easy, you look at a person and you can convince yourself they're guilty of something or other. So easy to say they did it on purpose. You don't know if they did it or not. It might be an accident. It may be just they were heedless. It may be they just got bad habits. You don't know why they do that. So I always like to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. And it doesn't matter how small that doubt is. I will always give that benefit of the doubt, no matter what you did, who you did, or who you did it to, or why you did it. Because I can't say why they did it. It's like you have a trial in a court of law, and the person who's upset you is in the dock. And I've noticed that when I used to get angry at people, now I would be the prosecutor and I'd also be the judge. And I'd put that person in the dock in my mind and I'd find all the reasons to find them guilty. I'd spin anything, I'd twist it to make it quite clear that they were guilty. And once I decided they were guilty, then as a judge, I decided they deserved my anger. They deserved some punishment. They deserved to be scolded or shouted out at something. I was the prosecutor and I was also the judge. And one day I realized that was very unfair. And coming from a liberal Western background, I thought, no, if you're going to have a trial of somebody in your own head, at least you should have a defense attorney. So as a prosecutor, yeah, you know, I sort of see all the reasons why that they did something wrong and all the worst possible ways of interpreting their actions. But then I'd pause and be a defense attorney and try to take their side and see things from their position and find some excuse, some loophole to get them off the rap. And when I did that, you know, as a judge listening to myself defending the person I was getting angry at, I couldn't get angry anymore. As a judge, I could not decide. And so I just gave them the benefit of the doubt and released them from the sentence of my anger. And that became a very, very useful way of never getting angry at a person. I just didn't know why they did that. And I just gave them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe, you know, she was having post-menstrual syndrome. Maybe he was a bit crazy today. Maybe his cricket team lost and he was taking it out on me. I don't know why they do these things, but you find any excuse, and any excuse will do, just to give them benefit of the doubt. And that's a giving. It's giving this beautiful space, you know, to people to be themselves and not just always just judging them because they don't live up into your space of what you think is appropriate or not. I mean, actually, you widen your acceptance of people and their attitudes. Because I've got a great faith in human beings. Now maybe it comes because my learning in Buddhism. Every human being, because they've been reborn in this realm, they're quite a high level of being. To get a human birth is not easy. And you have to have quite a lot of morality and a lot of kindness to even get to this realm. So when I think like that, I think that all these people, they may have done some terrible, terrible crimes and you see them in jail, But there must be some beautiful kindness, goodness inside of them, otherwise they would not have been born as a human being. And so when I remember that, I can always see some goodness and kindness in even the worst criminals. And when I see that, it just makes me much wider, and because I can forgive them and not always see their faults, as I've often said to you, I can see the other part of them as well, the good part of them. And when I see the good part of these criminals, you know, who working in a monastery, sometimes they work here, you know, you see them. I remember, I don't think they're working in here today, but some years ago when we had Singaporean group over here, the Buddhist Fellowship. There was one guy, he was a cook. And he was an incredible cook. Amazing just what this guy would produce just in one morning. And all the Singaporeans were just so impressed with him. And they just thought, wow, what a great fellow this is. And can we get that cook again? Can we invite him to Singapore to do the cooking? And I said, well, you can't because he's in prison. I said, what for? And I told him what he'd done. But they couldn't sort of know the crime and the person they got to knew first of all. It was so hard for them to reconcile the two. He was just a great guy. He was just so kind and just a great cook. And he really did give Bianca a run for her money. And, you know, I reckon he beat Bianca. He was just an amazing cook. But he was in prison up the road. He just was having a little bit of a community work release up here. And wasn't that beautiful that people could see that this was a criminal? You know, he's still in jail, you know, for a long time, but he always had this beautiful heart, and you saw it. And of course, because you saw it, he saw it too. And that is the beautiful thing about the change when you give people the benefit of the doubt. You don't see their faults, you see their good qualities, and those good qualities start to blossom. So be careful, whoever said that question last night about the husband, if you're always suspicious and you always see his faults, he's going to make more of those faults. You're actually encouraging him to be less faithful to you. Because that's what you see, that's what will grow. If you see his good qualities, those good qualities will grow. That's how it works. That's that story, I don't know how many times I tell this, but it always makes me inspired. When I went to the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore, it was their anniversary of something, and they wanted me to go there to give the keynote address at their conference to celebrate 50 or 60 years at that campus Woodlands, up in the north of the island, in Woodlands. And after giving my little speech, the professor of schizophrenia came up to me and said, thank you for that talk, great talk. And he asked me to come and bless his ward. He was a Christian. He said, no, I want you to come and bless my ward anyway, because obviously you know what you're talking about. But then just on the way to his ward, you know, of course, you know, you chat to people. I asked him, how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore these days? And that's when he said something which really hit me and just made me so inspired. He said, I don't treat schizophrenia in the schizophrenia ward of the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. What? You don't treat schizophrenia and you're the professor of schizophrenia? He said, just like you explained, Ajahn Brahm, I treat the other part of the patient, the part which is not schizophrenia. That's what I treat. And I thought, wow, you've understood. Well done. And I just gave him this big, you know, worship. I was worship a Christian layperson because I worship his wisdom. Well done. And I asked him, what are the results? And he smiled. I knew what he was going to say. Much, much better than by conventional treatment. Do you understand it? You get it? If you keep focusing on the schizophrenia, you're encouraging it. If you keep focusing on your husband's wayward eyes, you're encouraging them. That's basic psychology. And you try it out and that's what happens. So it's the same. When you focus on a person's faults, you're encouraging the faults. When you forgive, beautiful letting go, the faults start to vanish. That is the psychology of letting go. Giving, forgiving, it's not things will get worse. If I don't stop my husband now, he's going to have an affair with every pretty girl in the retreat center. Of course he won't. But that's why the forgiving is this beautiful mind. You can understand just how beautiful a mind that is, which can trust people and let people be and realize they're all trying their very best in each their own way. And that sort of encouragement, that type of forgiveness, is a beautiful thing. And it's one of the reasons why every time you come for your interviews and you tell me you haven't been meditating at all and you've been in your room checking your emails every day and you've been downloading movies on your tablet and watching those instead of looking to me and you've been... And sometimes people come and tell me that and I say, very good. And that's become such a joke in the monastery that, you know, all the monks, they know how to do interviews now. All they do is they sit there and they say, very good. No matter what you say, I've just, you know, killed all the other five people in my cottage because they make too much noise. Very good. Have you heard me say that to you when you come in there and you think, oh, crikey, I've done a really terrible day. I haven't really done much meditation. And I tell it to you. I say, very good to you. What are you doing that for? Because you're having this beautiful, non-critical mind. And people get a bit surprised. They think, I'm going to hit them, or I'm going to scold them, I'm going to chase them out of the retreat center. You're not coming ever again, you bad meditator. But that is not just not my character, that's not the Dhamma. You get this incredible forgiveness here. You let things be. This is good enough. You have this unconditional loving kindness. When you're in front of me, in the interview room, or the interview table, the door of my heart's open to you. No matter how stupid you are. It's a bit tough sometimes, a bit of a stretch. But I've always managed it somehow. Now what does that do to you? That takes off a lot of tension and tightness, doesn't it? Of always having to try and meet other people's expectations. Go and see the big boss. That should be really scary. You don't get scared at all. That's why I always try to imagine what it would be like to see the Buddha. It's an incredible, powerful being who can read your mind, who knows all the sexual fantasies you've been thinking this morning. They can know all of them. And what would the Buddha do? He wouldn't do anything. He'd just say, very good. Or something like that. And when he was such a kind and beautiful person like that, this is how I was taught. When I was with Ajahn Chah, some of these other great monks, you know, because I wasn't being criticized, because, you know, it was just, I was totally forgiven, all those bad, stupid things tended to fade away. They weren't important anymore. It's amazing how forgiveness actually increases people's goodness. They don't get worse, they get better. And that's a natural law. If you know psychology, you know, you understand how that works. But just in your life, you blame someone, you criticize them, they usually get worse. You forgive them, it uplifts them. And they just, what my father did when he said, you know, the door of my heart's open to you no matter what you ever do. It was a blank check. I could do whatever I wanted. I always had a house to go to. My dad would get me out of trouble. Well, I can't do that. Someone says something amazing like that to you, you just, the pressure's on you to live up to such trust. And you do, eventually. So that's this beautiful sense of forgiveness, which is a letting go. So, what was your meditation like this morning? Oh, it was terrible. Forgive it, never mind. So sometimes I even take my hand and I put it, never mind, Ajahn Brahm. I know you're supposed to be a great teacher, you're supposed to be enlightened, and you're supposed to be this and you're supposed to be that. But you can't be that all the time, never mind. You stuffed up this morning, never mind. So But you get an incredible sense of forgiveness. Imagine you forgive yourself anything. You'd be so free. No burdens on you. No just big brother looking over you, always checking you out. Did I tell you we've got these secret cameras in your room? And in my little room in the teacher room, we've got a big console so I can get Cottage 6A. What's she doing now? It would be terrible if you had things like that. That's just so controlled. That's big brother. We don't do that over here, but you still do that to yourself. The big brother, the CCTV camera, on your case every moment of the day. So hard on yourself. So imagine turning that off and just being free and having forgiveness, letting yourself be with all the stupidity, all the craziness, let it be. And the Buddha was saying that that is the path to nirvana. It's a giving. The next one, I better keep going on these ones because I've got another three to go. The next way of letting go is literally throwing things away. It's called patinisika. You take something and you throw it away. Now this was what Ajahn Chah used to do. As I remember, I took some people to Thailand some years ago, and I was walking from Wat Nanachat to Wat Bapong. It's about 6-8 kilometers, takes a couple of hours through the villages. And I remembered, you know, he had all these memories of when I was at Wat Bapong with Ajahn Chah. And I remembered the very place, it just walking past, it's where that happened, where Ajahn Chah, just coming back after alms round, he picked up a stick and he looked around and said, "Is this stick heavy?" It was quite a big stick. And before you had a chance to answer, he threw the stick into the forest. "It's only heavy when you're holding it." And that was the Dharma teaching of that day, which is a very beautiful one. It's only heavy when you're holding it. So what are you worried about? What are you concerned about? What happened to you in your past? It's only heavy when you're holding it. So throw it away. Some years ago I said that's a great way of letting go of all your problems in life. Whatever problems you've had in your past, write them down on a piece of paper. This is not the toilet one, this is another method. Write them down on an ordinary piece of paper. All the stuff you're really upset about, all the things you're afraid of, on a piece of paper, and then find a stick and get some elastic bands and tie it around the end of the stick. And then feel how heavy it is, holding on to all that rubbish, all those memories of the past, all those fears of the future. How heavy is it? And then go out into the forest and just throw it as far as you can. You let it go, and then you're free. And after the retreat's over, I'll go into the forest and collect all those pieces of paper. Find out the handwriting from your registration forms. And I have another way of raising funds. Oh, this is what Ananda did in the past. Oh, what does his wife know about this? You know, if I didn't have my precepts, I'd be very rich. You don't do this. But you can imagine that whole idea. It's only heavy when you hold it. So the whole idea of trying to work through your past and try and bring up all the pain, all the suffering, all the terrible things which happened to you, all the terrible things you did to other people. I disagree with that therapy in psychology. That's bringing up the past and it's heavy again. As soon as you possibly can, throw it away. Discard it. It's called patinisika. Renounce it. Throw it as far as you possibly can. Over a cliff. Into the river. So where I can't collect it afterwards. Whatever it is. Discard it. And this is this beautiful patinisika. You can throw it away. And you find that throwing things away, that's also where, you know, I developed the simile, you know, the suitcase simile. For those of you still having trouble being in the present moment, you do a little visualization. carrying two heavy suitcases or two heavy shopping bags. Many of you are going overseas again. You know, you're going back home in a couple of days, and I've seen your suitcases. Oh, God. You see my suitcase. I was having a photo of it one day. You know, when I go overseas and see my suitcase in my little brown bag, you can see it. I carry it to the office, you know, when I've got to do some work, carry it over to the monastery. It's only a little bag, a shoulder bag, that's all. Going over the world, going to Europe, to Canada, that's all I ever take, all I ever need. Because it's great being a monk, you don't need a change of clothes. The reason why this is brown is because you can spill anything on it and it doesn't show. If it's white, I mean, just spill a tiny bit of tea or coffee on it and you've got to go and wash it again. This, there's so many tea and coffee stains in here. Look, some over here. You see those? It's so practical. And I also told people that you use this as a bed sheet at night. And so this is my bed sheet, it's my robe. And also I told people that recently I went over to Europe and people were concerned because my flight was going over Iraq and Syria. Now that's a flight path, you can't do much about that. It's either that or go over Ukraine. This is very dangerous. And so a lot of people ask me, what happens, Ajahn Brahm, if you get shot down or you have to make an emergency landing in Baghdad? And you get out of that airport there and I'm a number one target to be kidnapped. Now, number one, I'm an infidel. You know, I'm a Buddhist monk. And they're not really looked upon very nicely by the Islamic State. And number two, I'm well known and famous. I could actually raise quite a ransom. When you auctioned me to raise funds for the nuns' monastery, I was auctioned about a year ago, and I went for 127,000. Imagine what, you know, you'd pay for me if ISIS ransomed me. So I'd be a good earner for them. It's very dangerous. So they said, what are you going to do? We don't want you to go over there. And I said, I've got my plan. You know, if it worst comes to the worst, and you do have to land, and you know, you walk down the streets of Baghdad or Syria, this robe, I'd put it over my head. I'd put a slit in here. And it'd be a burqa. And they would know who's underneath there. It'd just be like a brown, fashionable new burqa for people. So, this robe, and if it gets shot down over Ukraine, parachutes. It's amazing what you can use a robe for. It's so practical. And just one of them, which means you don't have to have different colours for this and that, and just one for the evening, one for the morning, one for the afternoon, one for shopping, one for relaxing. Oh, Jesus, that really makes it very difficult to live. So you have very few possessions. But with the suitcase in me, you carry two heavy suitcases. And you've done that before. So you imagine the two heavy suitcases or two heavy shopping bags. Will do if you don't carry suitcases. You've all done that in a shopping mall. Just carrying all these suitcases so heavy. And it makes your arms hurt and your shoulders ache. And it's such a common feeling. You can understand what it's like and you can remember it. But this time, in this visualization, you look at the shopping bag in the left hand and on the outside it's got the four letters P-A-S-T. The past. Because that shopping bag, that represents all of your memories, good and bad. It's so heavy, all those memories which you have. Now, if you're very old, it should be heavy, but even young people have heavy memories as well. And it's so heavy in there. And the bag in your right hand, it's got F-U-T-U-R-E written on the outside. And not Gucci, you know, not Versace, not what other shops, not Kohl's, not, oh, I don't know. Well, I don't go shopping. I don't know what these things. All these little shops. Bunnings. We do go to Bunnings. Bunnings on the outside. It's a boys' shop. You know, boys and monks go to Bunnings. And so, have all of this stuff. And that's F-U-T-U-R-E on the outside. So in there is all your fears, your plans, all the stuff you have to think about for the future. And that is so heavy too. And in this little exercise, you know, throwing things away, or at least putting things down. You imagine the heavy past you've been carrying for so many years. And you Imagine your back leaning to the left allows you to put down the shopping bag. And as soon as it hits the ground, no weight anymore, no burden. That allows you, once it's on the ground, that allows you to let it go. Open up your hand, straighten up your back, you put down the past. And then you can feel the weight of the other bag in the future. You lean to the right. Put the bag down on the floor. As soon as it meets the floor, all the weight vanishes and allows you to ungrasp the handle. Only now can you stop grasping it. Move the hand away and relax the right arm. You've let go of the future. And in this imaginary exercise, you visualize this. The next thing you do, wow, it's so nice to be free. Now your arms and hands can recuperate. Re-energize. And you look at the two bags on the ground there, past and future, and you're standing right between them in this incredible, wonderful place, right between the past and the future called now. And now you understand what the now is and why it's so free. You put down these very heavy burdens. Those suitcases or bags, past and future, you're going to have to pick them up afterwards. No one's going to take them away. But at least, for now, you can rest and relax and feel what it's like not to sort of keep carrying them. And that's what we do in meditation. It's throwing things away. At least for a small time. If you can actually throw them away forever and just walk away from those bags, that's the best. But sometimes you feel a bit irresponsible to do that. But at least you can empty many of those bags and so they're very, very light afterwards. That's called throwing out. Throwing out the past and the future. And the simile which I've also developed for meditation is imagine you're in one of these hot air balloons. There's a couple of similes of hot air balloons. I've never been up in a hot air balloon, but I know people who have. And they say as soon as you get high in the hot air balloon, it's always so peaceful up there in the sky. Even if it's a windy day, you can't hear or feel the wind because the balloon is so big that whichever way the wind is blowing, you go 100% with the wind. There's no resistance at all. So it's always very still, even if it's a windy day, because you go totally with the wind. And that was my first idea of letting go. Whatever your mind is doing, if you go totally with it, just like the balloon goes with the wind, you can't feel the wind anymore. You are just no resistance. You are letting go. And the result of that is perfect stillness. Even on a windy day, up there it's always still. Because no resistance anymore. Letting go. But the other part of going up in a balloon is you go up so far. If you want to go up further, you've got to throw something away from the basket. There's the ballast, these bags of sand. And you throw those out. Hopefully no one's underneath. And as soon as you throw it out, you go higher. And you go that high, and you can't go any higher. So you've got to find something else to throw out. So you throw out your lunch and your thermos. And your bottles of water and everything else. And then you go really high that way. All your possessions you throw out. And you go really, really high. And how can I go any higher? And you realize there's nothing in the basket, just me, the basket, and the balloon. And you finally figure it out. Untie the basket. You throw the basket off. And there you are holding on to the balloon, just you and the balloon. You go very high now. And then you go that high, and how can I go higher? And you realize, throw I off. And when you throw yourself off, then the balloon goes all the way to Nirvana. And in this simile, all those possessions, your past and the future, your lunch for the future, your memories of the past, your camera, and all those other possessions, you have to throw those out until there's just you. Your body and the balloon. the basket which you throw away is your body and five senses. When you get to my age, the body does resemble a basket case. So you've got to throw the body away. And that is letting go of the body and the five senses to get the jhanas. You go really high. There's just you in the balloon. Now what could I do to get further, to get all the way to nirvana? I'm in the jhanas, but how can I get to nirvana? You have to throw you off. The I is abandoned. And then the balloon goes all the way to nirvana. So like that, there's always something more you can throw away in meditation. So that's sometimes what you do. In meditating, when you're getting so far, and you can't go any further, what can I throw away? This is, you know, in your mind. All your wants, your cravings, all your plans of getting into jhana, this retreat. Now all the past memories. Remember that time you got a jhana 5-7 years ago? That is heavy ballast. You've got to throw that away, otherwise you'll never get up there. Throw all your past away, all your future away. All your other little possessions which you have. I'm talking about, you know, your pride, who you think you are. I'm a monk, I'm a good meditator, I'm a nun. You know, I should be able to do much better than anybody else because I'm a daughter of the Buddha. I better get up early. I better go to bed late. Well, throw those away. Now, both of you have always got up early. I challenge you, get up late tomorrow morning. My God, I'm proud. I'm a nun. So, see how much you can throw away. So, once you throw it away, you find you do go deeper in meditation, you go higher. And you get stuck somewhere, what are you holding on to? Throw it out. It comes to a stage where you're about to let go of your body. It's about to vanish. But you won't let it. You know, as fear comes up, you know, you just... Oh, this poor Singapore guy. I remember him, he was meditating and he came up to me. He was really, really distressed. I thought he had some sort of psychotic episode or something. He was really upset. So what happened? What happened? He said, I was meditating, and my hand started to disappear. Is that all? What about the rest of your body? Well, I was still there, but my hands started. I couldn't feel my hands. Ah, what's going on? This is what's supposed to happen. Don't be afraid. Let the whole of your body go. Especially your mouth, let that go and it's a piece of fire. So, you know, it's the first time something like that had happened and he was scared, he was very attached to his body. And each one of you, there comes a time when the body starts to vanish and you get terrified. Please learn how to throw that out. The body's just a pain. Everybody who's ever had these near-death experiences where they've died on the operating table, they always say that it's wonderful when your body vanishes. Oh, it's such a relief not having this heavy, achy, itchy, too hot, too cold body. Oh, and it's just such a pain. And you have to keep, you know, scratching your nose. You've got to keep wiping your nose. And another nose wiper over there. Somebody else has to sort of first scratch their cheeks. And I'm just saying what I'm seeing now. Everybody's always moving. Just see what people are doing. Just how many people, just you got to adjust your glasses, and you scratch your nose again, move your leg. You're scratching your nose again. And your glasses, moving them. This body is always so uncomfortable. We do all these movements, but no, we don't really notice them because they happen all the time. And we just take them for granted, having to move your hair, just there's always something happens in the body. And that's why it is a pain, but we've got so used to it, we don't recognize it. And then the time comes, the body vanishes. Ah, you are free. You don't have to scratch anything. You don't have to move your hands anymore. You don't have to yawn. You don't have to do anything. The body is now, you're free of it. And that's just such a bliss. So, this body, throw it away. It's a waste of time. It's in the meditation anyway. At least you can throw it away for a little while and be free of this body. That's thrown the basket away. And the last part is always you. My meditation. say, be a visitor. Don't own the meditation. I said also, Ajahn Brahm can't get jhanas. Ajahn Brahm has to disappear. I throw myself away. Bye-bye, Ajahn Brahm. And then all these incredible things happen. That's when the balloon goes into nirvana. When you throw yourself out. So this is seeing how much you can win, how much you can give away. It's much more than money. You just put yourself in the donation box. That's what we really do. So that's the throwing things away. The next way is mutti, which is literally means freedom. It means releasing. And how can you release yourself? It's just so easy what freedom is. I already mentioned, in brief, in passing, the two types of freedom in the world. Freedom of desire and freedom from desire. And the old story, most of you have heard it before, but this is a classic explanation of what enlightenment is. Because you know, some of your friends may ask you, you're a Buddhist, you're trying to become enlightened. What is enlightenment? Is it like a heaven realm? Just where, you know, you have the most delicious food whenever you want it. You always have the beautiful music from Jimi Hendrix, or you have whatever else you like. Is that what nirvana is? Just this amazing heaven where you can get whatever you want whenever you like it? Or what actually is it? I know for a Buddhist it's so hard to describe nirvana to someone who's not a Buddhist. If you say it's cessation, that's pretty depressing. For many people, if you don't know what you're talking about. So the best explanation, which is accurate, it's not only accurate, but it also shows you how it happens. And that's the old story of the five children playing the wishing game. Many of you know this one, so I'll go through it quickly. Five children playing the wishing game. The wishing game rules goes like this. The child who comes up with the best wish wins the wishing game. First child put a hand up and said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a new computer game. Very good. The next kid said, I could do much better than that. If I had a wish, I wish for my own computer game shop, so I can have many computer games whenever I want it. Very good. The third kid, very brilliant, said, no, even if I had my own computer game shop, my mummy would never let me play so much. She always says, do your homework. And then you can play a computer game. Really unfair. She doesn't understand. So, he said, if I had a wish, I would wish for $100 billion US. With $100 billion US, I can first of all buy my own computer game shop. And then the next thing, I buy my own school. Because if I go own my own school, then I don't need to go. And if those teachers don't give me straight A's, I can sack them. I own the place. And once I graduate from my own school, then I can buy my own university. You can do that too these days. And I can give myself first class honours in whatever subject I like because I own the university. And that means I can spend all my days playing computer games with $100 billion US. Whenever I think of something else I need, I can buy it. $100 billion US. You can't spend that in a lifetime. So it's as much money as I need. So that was actually a pretty good wish. There's two more kids in the wishing game. And both those children, the last two children, did a much better wish than having $100 billion US. And don't think $200 billion, because that's the same as $100 billion. It means more money than you can ever spend. So the fourth kid, really smart girl, she said, if I had a wish, I would wish for three wishes. For my first wish, I'll have the computer game shop. The second wish, I'll have the $100 billion US. And for my third wish, I'll have three more wishes. And I can go on forever. And that was a very, very smart wish, hard to beat. The infinity of wishes granted. And the last kid won the wishing game. They managed, if you haven't heard this before, this is the beautiful part. Because people always start to think themselves, how can you be an infinity of wishes granted? What's the answer to this riddle? It gets people involved. How can you beat that? And the last kid said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed a wish ever again. Now that is the Buddha describing enlightenment. And when you come, you know, in that little series of five children playing the wishing game, you can actually understand human life. Now, first of all, we want a little thing. You know, once I pass my exams or get my first house, you know, that's my wish. And then you want more, not just, you know, just a house, maybe a few houses for your investment in the future. And then next, you want $100 billion US, so you can always be financially secure for the rest of your life. And then, you know, realize that's not good enough. You want power, an infinity of wishes granted. And for many people, that's the acme. That's as far as they get, because they can't imagine anything more. So I always say, rich people, they always usually become presidents and dictators. You know, the rich, they've got lots of money, but why do they go into politics? Yeah, they've got money, but they haven't got enough power. So they want the infinity of wishes granted. They go to that fourth stage. And then above that, you get nirvana. So content, you don't need power, you don't need money. You're so content, you have no more wishes. That is called freedom, mutti. No wanting, no wishes. This is good enough. That is, for me, that's the highest form of letting go. So you're sitting here. What do you want? You want jhanas? You want streamlining? You want... If that's what you want, sorry, the path is blocked. And even the third Zen patriarch said, the path is easy for those with no preferences. That's the usual translation. I usually translate it, the path is easy for those who don't want anything. So simple, just don't want anything. See if you can go straight to the fifth child. So content, you don't need anything. But how can you be content? Many people say, oh, I'll be content once I get this, that and that out of the way. Then I'll be content. And you know your life so far. Getting things out of the way, and then I'll meditate, then I'll be content. You realize that's gone on for all your life and you still haven't stopped. There's no end of things to get out of the way. And you get one out of the way, another two come up to be getting out of the way. And that's the life. So you don't think this is good enough. This is good enough for me to be content. And quite frankly, if you can't be content in jhana grove, in the middle of a retreat, where the hell can you be content? I put so much effort and time into making this jhana grove a place of contentment, and still you try to make it different. Still you want something more. Still you try to change this and do that and blah, blah, blah. This is good enough. It's actually more than good enough. Isn't this place enough to be content? Or you still want something more? Whenever you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. That little saying which encapsulates the Four Noble Truths. So, enjoy the moment. Remember, this jhana and enlightenment is built up on bliss, upon bliss, upon bliss. So enjoy this moment by not wanting anything more. Be so content. You don't need any wishes anymore. Craving vanishes. When you let go of that, wow, now you're flying. That's freedom. And it's incredible when you experience that freedom, the freedom from desires. You realize just how many years, lifetimes, you've been tricked to thinking that craving and desires are your friend. That if you want hard enough, smart enough, you'll be happy. And that's why many, many people come to places like this, or they come to Buddhist societies or these other courses, because they think that it's not craving is not the problem, it's that craving is stupid sometimes. Sometimes we want the wrong things, or we don't know how to get what we want. So you go to all these motivational seminars to say, you too can be rich. You too can be like me. Follow my investment plan and you too can be free. Yeah, sure. So people always, they think that if they're smart enough, they can solve suffering. All you come here for is just to find skillful means. And here you find out it's a craving, it's a problem. Doesn't matter how wise you are, when you want something, you're going to suffer. Even wanting good things. So you learn how to let go. Let go of all wanting. Be so content. You don't need anything. Can you do that today? Be so content today, you don't need anything. You don't need dramas, you don't need streaming, you don't need anything. You're sitting here totally content. Interesting thing to try. That's called letting go. The third way of letting go. Otherwise known as wanting to be here. Because the story I usually tell, which I'm not going to tell because I haven't got much time. I've got 3 minutes to do the last one. But that story was about difference between a monastery and a prison. You know the whole story. One of our monks went to teach in a prison and they asked what's it like in a monastery. He told them what it's like in our monastery. And it was really austere compared to a prison in Western Australia. Had to get up early, food in one bowl, and just no TV, no sex, no entertainment. And you get all of that stuff in prison. So they were thinking, wow, this is terrible in your monastery. One of the prisoners actually said this to the monk because they liked him. They felt some compassion towards this poor monk. And when they heard just how tough he did things in the monastery, they said, it's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead? They gave an invitation into prison. And they had a point. Now, it is much more comfortable in prison than it is in Bodhidharma Monastery. You know, you can get a jacuzzi bath over there, and you can watch TV all night. You get TV in your rooms, and you can see the amount of food which you get in a prison. It's much more than even in Bodhidharma Monastery, and 4 or 5 meals a day. And if ever I wanted to go on retreat, all I need to do is to punch a prison officer, they give me 3 months solitary. Oh, joy! And anyway, afterwards I started thinking, what's the difference between a prison and a monastery? Even what's the difference between a prison and jhana grove? You don't get anything to eat in the evening. It's just like being in prison, isn't it? You can't, at least you're not supposed to sort of check your mobile phones. You're not supposed to do this, you're not supposed to do that. You have all these rules, 8 precepts. You know, you don't have 8 precepts in a prison. So what are you doing here? Why don't you sign up for 9 days in Hakea prison for your holiday? The only difference is because people want to be here and in the prison they don't want to be there. That's the only difference. And any place you do not want to be is a prison. And it's a very great insight because you see so many things in your life. You're at the airport and you're waiting for the plane to go. You don't want to be there, you want to be in the plane. You're now in a prison. You created another prison for yourself. You know, you're waiting for lunch. Now it's a prison for you again. You don't want to be here, you want to be at lunch. Some of you, you know, not the ones who are going today, some of you have already started packing. You're not leaving until Sunday. What are you doing that for? Don't you want to be here? How much of our life we always want to be somewhere else? Whenever you want to be somewhere else, this moment is now a prison for you. Any place you don't want to be is called prison. And you find, catch yourself doing that in meditation. You're sitting there, I don't want to be here. This is rotten. This is nasty meditation. Oh, this is awful. And you don't want to be there, you've now created a prison. You're not free. And it's so easy to let go and be free. All you need to do is change attitude. You don't need to get rid of your sickness. You don't need to get rid of your stupid, restless mind. You don't need to get rid of change the aircon and make it cooler or hotter, whatever it is for you. Change attitude. I want to be here. In this moment, I want to be here. Then you're free. Totally free. If they put me in prison, it wouldn't be a prison. I'd be totally free because this is great. And no one has to ask me any questions anymore. I can be free. If you want to be here, wherever that is, you are free. That is called letting go. desire creates prisons. Wanting to be somewhere else. In a marriage, you want to be somewhere else. Your marriage is a prison for you. In a job, you don't like your job. It feels like going to prison every morning. You don't need to change your partner. You don't need to change your job. Change attitude. Want to be here. Want to be with that guy, with that girl. And I'll give you some advice. All guys are the same. They are, you know. You get rid of one, you get another. You'll find that out for yourself. But you save yourself a lot of money if you learn that with the one you've got now. They're all the same, so stick with the one you've got. It's much cheaper. Girls are the same. All women are the same. Different chassis, same engine. That's all it is. So after a while, I'll stick with the one you've got. That's good enough. That is good enough. I don't want anything more. Then you have this beautiful sense of contentment and freedom. So during the meditations here, if you're in problems, difficulties, ask yourself, do I want to be here? Or is it I want to be somewhere else? And you'll find the biggest obstacle in meditation is always wanting to be somewhere else. And if you change your attitude to want to be here, this moment, no matter what it feels like, is teaching you something. Want to be here. And then you feel such great freedom. And the last way of letting go, which I've got minus 2 minutes to talk about, is called, it's the Teflon mind, Anulaya. I mentioned it in brief, it's like the lotus leaf. Nothing sticks to you. I think I said it in retreat anyway. You urinate on a lotus, you pee on it, and it leaves no smell. Afterwards you can smell the lotus, you can't smell the urine. Or you can pour Chanel No. 5. Please tell me what the modern perfume is. That was 40 years ago, Chanel. Have you still got Chanel No. 5? Is it still popular? Oh, she is amazing. But anyway, whatever is the most expensive popular perfume, you pour that on a lotus, and it too runs off the petals. It leaves no residue. So that's the other way of letting go. Having a mind which is like a lotus leaf. It leaves no residue. You just had the most amazing jhana experience. Wow. It leaves no residue. You don't hold the past. You just had the worst psychotic breakdown. It's like urinating on your mind. Like defecating on it. And afterwards, your lotus is as pure as it was before. The past leaves no residue. Nothing sticks to your mind. Thoughts, they come and they go right through. Nothing sticks. A mind as pure as a lotus. Teflon mind, I called it before, but I prefer lotus mind now. Where everything, as soon as it arises, it disappears, leaving no trace. The Teflon mind, the lotus leaf. Praise, blame, happiness, suffering, or what they call the Loka Dhammas, the 8 worldly Dhammas. Nothing sticks to you. Let it go. Free at last. Sadhu. 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 Yeah. Very good. Okay, there we go. Another talk I got away with. You know, some of these talks, like even today, I didn't know what I was going to talk about. I was going to talk about something else, but I get what that was now. Anyway, hope you enjoyed it. And remember, tonight, the questions are for the great sister.